I love the updates. I watch them every day, every time you send them.
Oh, great. Yeah. It's fun. It's fun to do it. Sometimes I'm not really all that awake. But
in fact, let me just clarify something. Those, are they dolmens?
Dolmens.
Dolmens. And those are like monoliths?
Yeah, they're huge, huge stones with, you know, uprights, and then they have this big tabletop sitting on top. Sometimes those are a meter and a half, two and a half meters across.
Are those like for tomb identifications?
Yeah, they're actually, I think they're secondary burials, actually. I don't think they're primary burials because we never find any whole skeletons. They're just bones, a few bones.
But you found that one tomb that was like unrated, right?
Yeah, this was a dolmen that was untouched. And it was there haven't been very many intact dolmens excavated.
Wow. Well, what time is it over there?
It is getting up on 10 o'clock.
Oh, my goodness. Really? Okay, I won't keep you up. I'm ready to go when you are.
I'm ready.
Okay, well, here we go. Well, Dr. Steve Collins, first of all, thanks for joining us all the way from Jordan. Great to hear your voice.
It's great to be here and there with you.
Now, Steve, you're on, is it your fifth year of excavation?
This is season five, that's right.
Season five, and we want to let our listeners know where you are and what you're digging. You're in the country of Jordan, and you're digging a site called, is it Tal El Hammam?
That's correct.
And tell us what that is and why that's important.
Well, we're about 14 kilometers northeast of the Dead Sea, and we believe this is the site of biblical Sodom.
Okay, so you say that's the site of biblical Sodom, and yet if I were to look at the back of my Bible or in a map of the Holy Land, they would say Sodom is typically, isn't it on the other side of the Jordan in Israel somewhere?
Well, they would either put it there or on the Jordan side, but they'd certainly put it toward the south end of the Dead Sea. And that's the typical viewpoint that we've gotten or inherited from W.F. Albright and G.E. Albright and G.E. Wright and some of the older scholars from the 20th century.
So why did they start looking for it there? Let's start there before we ask you why that's not it.
Well, the only reason that I can find that actually took them there was that if you go down there, it actually looks like a place that would have been destroyed by fire from heaven. It's pretty, pretty salty and dry and ugly down there.
Okay. So did they do excavations to substantiate their viewpoint?
No, actually, Albright knew that most of the cities down there were from the early Bronze Age. That's from a time several hundred years before Abraham was ever born. So he never associated any of the cities around the south end of the Dead Sea with Sodom. What he did was he theorized that, well, maybe Sodom was sunk under the shallow waters at the south end of the Dead Sea after their destruction.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the theory he put forth, and so many people bought that theory. And if you look in the Bible encyclopedias today, that's probably what you're going to read.
So what you're telling us is that little dot that would say Sodom in the back of a Bible map, there's no substantive science backing that up.
Exactly. There's no city there. In fact, the place called Mount Sodom, all the locations around there, there's nothing there that would associate with the time of Abraham at all.
Okay, so Steve, tell us your journey. What caused you to rethink this, and why do you think topographically, geographically, along with biblically, that you're at the spot that is Sodom?
Well, I used to take people down to the southern sites around the south end of the Dead Sea on tours, showing them Sodom and Gomorrah. I didn't have a problem with that particular location until one day, probably a decade ago now, I started reading the Bible a little bit more carefully, and you read Genesis 13, 1 through 12, and you see that there really isn't anything in the text that would locate Sodom toward the south end of the Dead Sea, but everything would locate it north and east of the Dead Sea, and pretty much opposite Jericho. In fact, the Bible says that when Abraham and Lot separated, and you recall that story, when they separated, it says, Lot then looked, lifted up his eyes and looked and saw that the circle of the Jordan was well watered. like the Garden of Yahweh and like the land of Egypt. And, of course, that is very descriptive. And when we talk about the Jordan River system coming down through the lower part of the Jordan Valley, which is just like a large disc or a circle, and it's very well watered, like Egypt, the Jordan River overflowed its banks just like the Nile in antiquity. It doesn't now.
Right.
But in antiquity, it would overflow its banks and get several kilometers wide during the spring melt from the Lebanon snows. And it would overflow its banks. They would plant behind the receding waters. It was just like a Nile in miniature. So everything about that story says that it was north and east of the Dead Sea. Bethel and Ai, which is where he was standing when he saw the cities of the plain, is right above Jericho. It's sort of west-northwest above Jericho, high on the plateau, just 10 miles north of Jerusalem, which places his line of sight north of the Dead Sea. And he says he saw that well-watered plain, and traveled eastward and pitched his tent as far as Sodom. Anything in that story at all, it's what I call a serial geography, taking us from location to location. There isn't anything in that that would locate Lot's travels going south. Everything is happening north of the Dead Sea, and he's only traveling eastward, the text. So if you follow the text, it takes you exactly to the location of the cities that are there. It's just, it isn't a matter of going to a location and trying to sort of grasp for straws, trying to speculate about what may or may not be there. We actually have been able to find all of the Bronze Age cities, in fact, more than we need for the biblical story. And, of course, the very biggest one of those ought to be Sodom itself. And that's what Tal el Hammam is. It's the largest middle Bronze Age city, which is the time of Abraham. It's the largest such city in that whole region. In fact, we now know it to be the largest Bronze Age city in the whole southern Levant, and that would be Israel, Jordan, Lebanon, southern Syria. So it's really, really big, and of course the Bible always talks about Sodom first. It's always mentioned first. It's the only one ever mentioned by itself. King Bera of Sodom in Genesis is sort of the spokesman, the head guy of all those other kingdoms.
Yes.
And so it stands to reason that Sodom, according to the Bible, would be the largest Bronze Age city in the area. Well, if you go north and east of the Dead Sea and look for the largest Bronze Age city, you don't have to look too far. Tal el Hammam is many, many times larger than all the other cities in the area put together. And by the way, it would be much larger, probably 10, 12 times larger than Jericho.
Really?
At least that much larger than Jerusalem of the same period. So Melchizedek's Jerusalem of the same story would be a very, very small little, almost a little out-of-the-way place compared to Sodom or Tal el Hammam, which is a very large fortified city, the biggest in the region. So it was really big potatoes.
Yes. Steve, when anybody goes to the Middle East, especially a tour to Israel, there's something that they see, and it's something that we're saying that they may not understand. When we're in Israel, they'll point to an artificial hill, and they'll call it, they say that's a tell, or in Arabic, tal. It's identifiable to spot what would be an ancient civilization that begs for an archaeologist to come and uncover it. I mean, so when you were out there, you saw this artificial hill, this tal, that you suspected was Sodom. Is that right?
Yes. In fact, we did a lot of exploration in the region, and there are many, many sites that take on this typical large, steep hill shape with a flat top, and of course they're built up that way because you have many centuries, if not millennia, of destruction and rebuilding over and over again, which builds them up quite high, in fact. And so they're quite easy to spot, and when you have a very large one, it's even easier to spot. The thing with Tal el Hammam is it's so big that when you see it from a distance, you really don't know what you're looking at. It almost looks like it's a natural hill, small mountain. It's so big. So compared to the other sites that you see around, it's much, much bigger. Hmm. And once you actually get there and stand on the site, it's huge. Mm-hmm. It's massive. Takes us. In fact, sometimes I have people come for tours around the site. Other archaeologists, different folks come from Jordan or Israel who are visiting, and they come over to take a look for themselves. And it takes about 2 hours to walk them around the perimeter of the site. That's how big it is.
Yeah. Yeah, I've seen, you know, one of the great things, I get your updates and I see the pictures that you send, and people don't appreciate what it takes to uncover an area, because you have to do it slowly, meticulously, going through the different strata and identifying them, identifying pottery and the laying of stones and destructions. It's quite a task just to do a small area, isn't it?
It really is. We've got a trench. We call it our big trench. We've got a trench going that is 60 meters long. I mean, that's about 70 yards of a football field.
Wow.
So it's a huge trench. And when we're down in it and we're looking at the Bronze Age fortifications that cut through it, the fortifications themselves are up to 5.5 meters thick. So you've got walls that are 16, 17 feet thick. And you can imagine how big of a wall that is.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, when we stand on the upper tell, looking down on where we're excavating in our big trench, it looks like a chicken scratch. The size of the site as a whole dwarfs the excavations that we've done, even though when we're in the excavation we think, oh my, look at this huge trench, look how much we've exposed, yet it's not probably less than 1% of the city, even less than that.
Well, Steve, let's just kind of go back in our minds, and you have a vast knowledge of the Bible, to the story of Sodom and Gomorrah in the Old Testament. The biblical text said it was destroyed by fire and brimstone. And I think maybe people listen to that or look at the text and they think, well, that's just phenomenal language. It's not literal. It's probably figurative, or it means something else. You would expect to find some kind of evidence of this. Tell us about what you found in Sodom that would lend you and others to believe this is biblical Sodom.
Well, the biggest thing is, here you have a huge Bronze Age city that came to a screeching halt sometime toward the end of the Middle Bronze Age, which biblically is the time of Abraham. And not only that site, but all the other associated cities, towns, and villages of the same period in the same area were all destroyed at exactly the same time. Now, that's not such a big deal until you realize that none of these sites, after that destruction, were occupied for the next 600 to 700 years.
Huh.
And when you multiply that by the fact that other civilizations in the immediate vicinity beyond that part of the Jordan Valley, you go up in the Jordan Valley, that destruction doesn't occur. The Late Bronze Age just continues there. We have the Late Bronze Age continuing up on the hills at Amman and up at Nebo and over in Jerusalem. And yet you come down in the circle of the Southern Jordan Valley, all these cities are destroyed toward the end of the Middle Bronze Age. They have no Late Bronze Age. They go all the way down for at least 700 years before anybody ever moves back into that location.
Huh.
Now that's very interesting, since the cities there were operating for over 2,000 years, when other cities were coming and going, being destroyed, having gaps in occupation. The site that we're excavating has a continuous occupation without gaps, without breaks, for over 2,000 years, and then it and all of its associated satellites come to a screeching halt suddenly toward the end of the Middle Bronze Age, and nobody lives in that area for the next 6 to 7 centuries. Now, that's pretty powerful.
Yes.
Here you have, you know, what I always say is, something happened to punch a hole, a terminal hole, in the Bronze Age, in that location only. Not everywhere else around it, just in that location.
Hmm.
And when you look at that, and then you see the destruction, particularly on the upper tail, where you have a meter of ash and destruction debris, on the lower tail, where the terminal destruction is actually the final phase. When you walk on our lower tail, and you walk across, say, 500 meters from one city wall to the other city wall, you're walking on the city that was destroyed by that event. And what's interesting about that is you should be seeing mounds and mounds of decomposed mud brick if it were a typical city that mm-hmm. just went out of business and went into ruins. It's all made of mud brick. So it should just melt, deteriorate, disintegrate. And yet you're walking around on stone foundations, and you have an entire city that's almost been erased.
Hmm.
And you get the feeling that, wow, this city was massive, it was huge, it was rich, it was powerful and politically controlling the entire area, but yet it's gone. And what happened to it? It was absolutely just obliterated, wiped out, wiped off the face of the earth in a certain way of looking at mm-hmm. it. Even though there's still ruins there, you can tell there ought to be more there than there is.
Hmm.
And so something dramatic occurred, and exactly from a scientific point of view, exactly what occurred, we don't know. But we know that it ended, and that's that's, to me, the biggest thing. It ended mysteriously, catastrophically, and yet we don't know exactly what it was.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the fact that the time is the same as the destruction in the Bible in the time of Abraham, the fact that those two things coordinate in location, in chronology, tells me that they cannot be a coincidence.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that there's such a correspondence between what the Bible says about the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah and what the archaeology and the geography tells us about the location and the destruction of these cities, there cannot be any kind of coincidence mm. here. There's a correspondence, not a coincidence.
Right.
And so we talk about fire and brimstone. In fact, the text says... literally, fire and brimstone, not burning sulfur, as some translations have it. So the Hebrew word goprit actually means sulfur in the later Hebrew, but in the earlier Semitic cognates and even in the Bible itself, it actually can be a reference to lightning or some kind of... electromagnetic discharge. In fact, the base meaning of the word is the material of which lightning consists to an ancient mind.
Hmm.
And so fire and brimstone may not be talking about sulfur. It's certainly talking about something hot, fiery, that consumes, but the goprit may be a reference to lightning or other kinds of electromagnetic discharges that would be associated with some kind of event, some kind of airburst, some kind of cosmic event that comes out of the heavens. And some geologists and archaeologists dealing with Sodom and Gomorrah had speculated that possibly there was an earthquake and the earth opened up and natural gas, belched out, caught on fire, and then descended back down upon the cities, which doesn't make any sense, because you're either going to take the biblical text seriously or you're not. Biblical text says the fire came from the heavens. And when you have fire from the heavens, I take it literally. It's fire from the heavens. It's not something that came out of the ground and then consumed the cities. If that happened, why doesn't the author say that?
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't. You know, Moses, the Genesis writer, is describing a heaven-born event. And when you look at it in those terms, you have to say, well, okay, what kind of events are there that come out of the sky and consume cities? Well, it hasn't happened very often, but you recall way back in 1908 in Tunguska, Siberia, there was an airburst event, a comet fragment or some kind of piece of space debris came out of the sky, traveling 50 to 80,000 miles an hour, burned up in the atmosphere, impacted upon the surface, left no crater, and completely obliterated 1,200 square miles of Siberian forest in an instant. Now, that's pretty interesting stuff. And scientists, by the way, that's sort of the hottest thing in astrophysics today, is to go study the Tunguska, Siberia, what they call cosmic bomb or airburst. And yet scientists have been looking at that thing for about 80 years. They've been intensively studying it for the last 10 with all the modern technological advances that they can apply to it today, and they can't figure out what it was. They know what happened, but they have no chemical, no radiological signatures, anything that would identify it as a specific kind of event. So what I tell people is that if you have a known event like the 1908 Tunguska airburst, in Siberia, and you can study that, and you still can't tell what happened. How are we going to, if something like that occurred in the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah 3,500-4,000 years ago, how are we going to tell that, anything about that? How are we going to investigate that?
Right.
So I just say, listen, the text says God destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah with fire from heaven.
Mm-hmm.
Put that on the one side. The archaeology says that a group of cities in the identical location described by the Bible were destroyed by some mysterious event at the same moment in history. Now, I don't think you can see that as coincidence.
Mm-hmm.
I think that has to be correspondence. That is, there's a one-to-one relationship there. And when you look at it like that, it makes a great deal of sense.
Mm-hmm.
And so we've got some very powerful evidence, I think, that those two things go together. Why would an ancient writer, whether it was Moses or anybody else, why would an ancient writer make up a story about fireball of some sort coming out of the heavens, consuming well-known cities that have been there for literally hundreds, if not thousands, of years, and you know they were there one day, and the next day they're not there, and that fireball would have scared the local residents around that weren't killed by it, would scare them to death, keep them from coming back into the area, certainly for a long, long time. And you can begin to understand that the event that they're describing is not something that they made up. It wasn't something they just pulled out of thin air. It was something that frightened people, that impressed them, impressed a historical memory upon the whole region. And I can't go anyplace else with it. The biblical story, isn't it interesting that the biblical story is the only such story that we have preserved in the written record of the ancient world, and that particular event or the termination of all the cities in that particular area actually did occur?
Well, Steve, here's the question that I think everybody's asking. You would expect, here you're at the Middle Bronze Age level and the time of Abraham. You would expect to find some kind of evidence of destruction by heat if that's what the Bible indicates and you're digging there, have you found any such evidence that it has been destroyed by some catastrophic heat event?
We've found some bits and pieces of melted material, pieces of pottery, little pieces of what we call desert glass that we've been picking up for quite a number of years now around the area. And they're quite intriguing. They're interesting. The desert glass is known only to be caused by these kinds of impact or airburst events, and not by anything terrestrially occurring, but simply these blast events that come out of the sky. I think that's interesting.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
From a scientific point of view, right now it's difficult to tie that to the destruction of those cities, except it's all in the same mix.
Mm-hmm.
All of that destruction, this burning, the melted surface of some pottery that we found, the desert glass, which is caused by these kinds of the heat impacts, all of that multiplied with the destruction of the cities that do exist, is very interesting. By the way, when these things occur, you don't necessarily see evidence of the destruction over a very long period of time afterwards, because the blast is so dramatic that it literally would destroy so much of what's on the ground that there wouldn't be much left. It would just literally blow it off or push it off. I mean, it's very much like an atomic-style explosion.
Hmm.
So the blast is very powerful. The shock wave of it is extremely, it's just absolutely catastrophic when it hits the ground, and would literally, well, the biblical phrase for it says God overturned them.
Yes.
It's sort of like flipping a pancake.
Hmm.
That God overturned those cities. He overturned the cities of the plain. This would be, if it's coming in at an oblique angle, that would be exactly what would happen. It would literally flip them over. Just take that mud brick city and just wipe it up off its foundations and literally push it into the next county, so to speak.
Huh.
So anyway, those things are, you know, we speculate about those things, but it's at this much time, from a scientific point of view, several thousand years later, it's difficult to pin it down. So therefore, what we're looking at mostly is the fact that we have a catastrophic destruction of an area, and people did not return to that area to live until 600-700 years later.
My.
Now, when you think of the fact that the area is the most well-watered, fertile agricultural region in the entire southern
right.
Lebanon, talking about Israel, Jordan, Syria.
There'd have to be a compelling reason that would keep them out.
Yeah, why wouldn't people come back and live there? Why would the civilization stop so suddenly, and why would people stay out for such a long period of time?
Right.
It doesn't make any sense. I mean, you can grow crops down here in the Jordan Valley for 12 months of the year. You can get three harvests down here.
Hmm.
And it was the most highly populated area in the ancient world, in the ancient Middle East.
Yep.
And where did all these people go? Why didn't they come back? The interesting thing biblically, Skip, is that the Bible says when Moses came back to the same area called the Plains of Moab, opposite Jericho, when Moses came to that area, the Bible indicates pretty clearly that nobody was home.
Hmm.
So in the time of Abraham and Lot, it's called the well-watered plain of the Jordan. In the time of Moses, in Numbers 21:20, it's called the wasteland below Pisgah.
Right.
So it's called an uninhabited wasteland in the time of Moses. it's called the well-watered plain in the time of Abraham. What happened between the two? Well, we know what happened. There was this fiery destruction that occurred in the judgment of Sodom. So all of that fits. It's a fit geographically. It's a fit chronologically. It's a fit in terms of the terminal destruction of those cities, of a whole civilization.
Well, Steve, you can't do this kind of work without catching the eye of the academic community, and no doubt having disdain poured upon you because of it. Tell me what the academic community, how are they responding to your theory and your work?
Well, you really have to look at it from two different perspectives. From the geographical perspective, it's pretty much a slam dunk. Most of the scholars that I talk to, that I've interacted with, and I'm talking about some of the most liberal ones, some of the guys who are atheists, they really don't take the Bible seriously, even though one of the guys who's known as the top biblical geographer in the world is not a believer of any kind. He's pretty much an atheist.
Mm-hmm.
He buys the location because of the argument of the Kikar, the circle of the Jordan Valley. All of that. The word plain there in the text is the word Hebrew word kikar. It's the cities of the kikar, the disc, the circle. And it's called the circle of the Jordan, the kikar of the Jordan. I call it the Jordan disc. That argument that area is only a reference to the circular area of the Jordan Valley, north and east of the Dead Sea, or just north of the Dead Sea, that's a strong argument, and most scholars have already bought off on that. I mean, they're perfectly willing to say, you're right about that. This is the area that the Bible's talking about. Now, they don't believe that the story actually occurred the way the Bible describes it, if at all. But I've pointed something out to them, and this seems to be a very powerful argument for the more liberal scholars, just geographically, and that is ancient people don't make up fictitious geography.
Mm-hmm.
So in the ancient world, in the ancient Near East, there's no such thing as the five-acre wood and Middle Earth, things like that.
See, that's an important, important point. Say that again and just zero in on that, because that's huge.
Yeah, my point is, and I've said this in so many venues, that ancient people never make up fictitious geography.
Mm.
So you look at the ancient writers of Egypt, Mesopotamia, the Bible. All the geography is real. Whether the stories they tell or the characters they use are fact or fiction, all of those stories are layered over a real-world geography.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we're talking about geography, talking about locations, ancient writers have no such concept, like we would say C.S. Lewis's Middle Earth or is that Tolkien?
Tolkien.
Middle Earth or... in the stories of Milne, the five-acre wood.
Right.
We don't have anything like that in the ancient world. They don't make up fictitious places.
Mm-hmm.
They might tell mythological stories about real places, but the places are, in fact, real.
Mm-hmm.
So when you talk about the stories of Sodom and Gomorrah, even with a very liberal scholar, what I've found is I can at least get them to agree with me on the basis of the location. And I found that to be a fairly easy thing to do because the biblical text is so very specific about the location of Sodom and Gomorrah being north and east of the Dead Sea on the circle of the Jordan. When I talk about that and I show them point by point by point in the text what the geography is, they all just sort of throw up their hands and go, yeah, that's it. You know, what else can it be? You're right about that.
So are you saying the academic community is in agreement with you?
Well, I wouldn't say everybody is at this point, because, you know, a new discovery in archaeology, trying to change old ideas, old conventions, takes about 20 years. So I'm not going to say 5 years into our excavation we're going to have everybody convinced, because, you know, the wheels move pretty slow here. But I would say that a fair number of what I would say are the big representative scholars in archaeology in Israel, Jordan, are now beginning to at least say, yes, we agree with you on the location.
Mm. Huh.
And now there are still a lot of conservative scholars, even some evangelical scholars, who've been rather resistant to the idea because, frankly, in the last 50 years, almost all the conservative Bible scholars had completely bought everything W.F. Albright, G.E. Wright ever said, and they were the ones that came up with that theory that Sodom and Gomorrah were under the waters at the south end of the Dead Sea. So they're the ones that came up with that theory. The evangelical scholars, the conservative scholars, bought that, swallowed it hook, line, and sinker, and that's what you find in all the Bible dictionaries, Bible encyclopedias, and all the commentaries. And it's been very difficult to change the minds of some of the more conservative scholars as a result of that, because they just it's such an accepted idea to have Sodom in the south end of the Dead Sea. So, you know, we're sort of fighting against tradition, but I'd much rather be fighting against tradition when I'm accepting the literal understanding of the geography of the Bible. I'll take the Bible literally, you know. Let the tradition fly out the window. I'm going to go with what the text says.
Yes. Let's talk a little bit more about the coverage that you've gotten. And I think our listeners would be interested to know that you were sort of hosted in a Wall Street Journal front page story. Tell us about that and the publicity since then.
Yeah, I think that was in 2007, spring 2007. Wall Street Journal sent a reporter out to do a story on the dig, and it wound up on the front page of the Wall Street Journal. And, you know, it's okay to get headlines like that, but his twist on it was such that it made it look like goofy Christians scratching around in the Jordanian desert looking for Sodom. And, you know, it was pretty upsetting to me. Other people read it and they said, "Oh, you know, you're too sensitive. Exposure is exposure, you know."
Right.
Publicity is publicity. Just take it for what it is. But still, from a scientific point of view, I get really upset when people don't show the credibility of the work that we're doing.
Yes.
And so I was a little bit upset by that, but since then, there's been a lot of attention to it. Biblical Archaeology Review magazine,
mm-hmm.
Of course, has been placing our dig in the find a dig portion of their publications and on their websites for a number of years now. People are looking for an excavation to go to, they can find us there.
Uh-huh.
But they've also written a nice article. Now, they've never gotten us into the magazine. You know, he's the magazine that says, or the editor is the one that said, well, Collins uses the Bible too much.
Right.
So it's probably why they've avoided me. But they actually did a pretty nice article on their website.
Yeah, and yet the magazine's called Biblical Archaeology Review.
Kind of interesting, yeah. That he would take that perspective, but it is what it is, and it's, you know, it's not exactly a conservative magazine.
No,
fairly liberal, in fact. But people like Eric Klein of George Washington University wrote a reasonably nice piece in his chapter on Sodom and Gomorrah in a book he wrote a couple of years ago called From Eden to Exile, and so, you know. It was as complimentary, I suppose, as it could have been under the circumstances, knowing who it came from. So, you know, you get this stuff coming out in books and in the press, but the big thing right now, Skip, is our first major publication on Tal el-Hammam in the scientific literature. So it just came out this month.
Wow.
And they brought, in fact, some of the guys from the Department of Antiquities here brought stacks of them out to the dig one day to give them to me and to other members of the team. And we were all very excited, and they were excited.
Because, sure.
This is the first publication documenting 4 years of excavation at Tal el-Hammam in the annual of the Department of Antiquities of Jordan, ADAJ. And so it's a great publication. This is where all the digs in Jordan get written up. Huh. And we were very very excited to be in that. Have a really nice long article.
Good.
And so we were very excited. Now what's happening is that scholars have already been picking up on that, even pre-publication. We're picking up on that, quoting it in their articles, talking about particularly the fortification systems that we have are just really kind of unprecedented.
Huh.
And so all that's very exciting. So it's getting out there in the literature. It's, you know, the Sodom discussion is important to me in terms of biblical credibility. But as a scientific project, the Tal HaMoM excavation is really going into the record books now as showing an unprecedented site that is occupied literally as long, maybe longer than any other site in the area, continuously.
Mm-hmm.
And so we go all the way back to the beginning of, about the time Noah came off the flood and people got this far, from that time forward until its destruction, people were living in this great city.
Steve, let's go back to a criticism that we were just mentioning, one maybe from Biblical Archaeology Review, other scholars, and that is your use of the Bible. Because I know you to be a linguist, an expert in lots of different disciplines, including science of archaeology. And one of the criticisms you've received is no responsible scholar goes to the Holy Land with a trowel in one hand and a Bible in the other. Now, that's what you're doing. And how have you responded to that charge?
Yeah, of course, that quotation comes from Bill Deaver, William Deaver, who's considered sort of the dean of American biblical archaeologists. And the irony of that is that in most parts of the world where you're doing archaeology without the benefit of a text, like even in the American Southwest, you know, we do Native American archaeology, but they didn't have a written language. We'd love to have texts to work with in that part of the world. But here we have a fabulous geographical text, a fabulous historical text like the Bible, and to go into the area where the Bible events took place and not to take the book and use it in the archaeological investigation of that area, would be and is absolutely irresponsible.
Yes. In fact, it would be right, I think, to say that not a whole lot of people would really care to even look in these areas were it not first mentioned in the Bible to give us a tip-off.
Exactly. How many people in Uzbekistan are interested in New Mexico archaeology?
Yep, there you go.
It would be exactly the same thing. If it weren't for the Bible, nobody would care about archaeology in Israel, Jordan, in this part of the world. I mean, you've got Egypt, that's very impressive. You've got Mesopotamia, it's very impressive. And compared to that, what are these little Canaanite cities?
Mm-hmm.
In comparison,
uh-huh.
Who would care about the land of Canaan? Who would care about the area where most of the Bible stories took place if it weren't for the Bible characters and the events themselves?
Right.
And so you take the Bible out of the equation of, say, Cyril, a lot of time has been called Levantine or Syro-Palestinian archaeology, or what we call the Bible lands archaeology. If you take the Bible out of that equation and just do archaeology for archaeology's sake and ignore the text, you have sort of a colloquial, localized archaeology that might be of some local interest, but the world just won't care.
Mm-hmm.
Don't care. Why would anybody come over here to do anything in this area?
Mm-hmm.
I go to Hawaii. I want to go on vacation. I go here. I go here because of the Bible.
Right, right.
And that's it.
Yep.
That's why people come here. And that's probably For a lot of it, the only reason why a lot of people come here.
Yes. Steve, I want you to paint a picture for us really quickly, because when people hear excavation and archaeology, they might get the impression that you're out there sitting behind a bulldozer, pulling a few levers and digging into the earth and taking a few pictures. It's painstaking work. So paint the picture. What is a typical day like for Dr. Steve Collins and his crew excavating Sodom?
We get up about 5:30 in the morning, 5:30. We hit breakfast at 6, and we're on the bus headed to the site by 7 o'clock. We get to the site. We park in the parking lot of the mosque that's right at the base of the tell, and we unload our tools from a storage room there right at the mosque. I'm probably the only evangelical that has a key to a mosque.
Yeah, I was going to say, do you hear the muezzin calling 5 times a day?
Absolutely, and we know the guys that do it.
Yeah.
I mean, we know them by name, so that's kind of interesting. So we take all the tools out of our storage there, and we load those on Ibrahim's truck, one of our faithful workers, who actually has a Toyota pickup, which is nice. So we load all the equipment on the back of his pickup, and he drives it out to the other side of the tell for us, because now we're working about a three-quarters of a kilometer away, six-tenths of a mile or so away from where our tools are stored,
mm-hmm.
on the other end of the tell. So he drives it around, and we walk. So we walk. It takes about 8-10 minutes to walk from the parking lot back around the tell to where we're digging, and then we unload the tools on the other end. And, of course, each one of our supervisors has a set of tools designated to them and the group of people that work with them, the volunteers that dig with them in their excavation squares. And a square, when I refer to a square, I mean a 6 by 6 meter area that is surveyed and strung up with survey string, and they work inside that confined area. And we use small picks called petiches, the little hand picks, and small trowels, and dustpans and brushes.
Hmm.
And we take the dirt down a few, maybe an inch or two at a time, horizontally across that entire 6 by 6 meter area. Oh, man. Until we run into walls or fireplaces or other kinds of installations. And, of course, then we change our digging strategy. We'll dig those things separately. But as that dirt goes down, I always tell people, imagine the dirt coming out of an excavation square like water draining out of a bathtub.
Huh.
So as you watch the water drain out of a bathtub, and you've got all those bathtub toys that your kids play with, and you watch that water drain down, what happens? Well, all of those things slowly appear. The water drains down around them, and they appear above the water. Well, that's sort of how it works. You want to peel that dirt back very carefully and watch it drain down. And as it drains down, the pottery comes out. The grindstones come out, the various kinds of implements, artifacts that were used by those ancient people begin to emerge from the soil.
Hmm.
And it's a very slow process. Now, when you're talking about walls and fortification systems that are massive, I mentioned our 5.2 meter, that almost 17 foot thick Bronze Age city wall. By the way, we have two different fortification systems, one for the early Bronze and one for the middle Bronze Age. So we have these massive fortifications, and you can imagine using small picks and brushes and dustpans to move the dirt, how long it takes to dig one of those out. And so it takes literally sometimes weeks just to expose a few feet of an area. So it's a very, very slow process. But as those things emerge, then what you're getting is the history of those people who live there. You're getting inside their houses. You're looking at the doorways through which they walked. You're walking on the streets that they walked on.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, we just uncovered this season a a section of the street between the city wall and the first house inside the city wall, about a 10 meter wide street that dates from the Middle Bronze Age, from the time of Abraham, which is part of that terminal destruction.
Mm-hmm.
And you can walk on that street.
Mm.
And I thought that was pretty cool.
Very cool.
Be able to stand on a street, walk on a street that Lot walked on, that
yep.
the angels that visited Lot walked on. I mean, it just, you're standing there going, wow. This is unbelievable.
Very, very hard work, very rewarding work. Steve, one final question. Do you see any benefit for somebody saving money and taking a trip to Israel? We take tours, you've taken tours. Is there any benefit, and why should somebody do that? What benefit would they get just spending a couple weeks looking around the land of the Bible?
What I would say, what I always say about that, Skip, is that people read the Bible, and it's often very black and white and two-dimensional. But when you come to the Holy Land, you actually get the dimensionality, the three dimensions, sight and sound and smell and the feel mm-hmm. and the emotion mm-hmm. of being in the land mm-hmm. where the Bible took place. Mm-hmm. I always tell people, coming to the land and being in Jerusalem, seeing the Jordan River, looking at the Temple Mount, things of that nature. When you do that, it's gonna set your Bible study ahead by 10 years.
Hmm. Hmm. That's
so
good.
It'll advance your Bible study by 10 years, and it'll do something to you that just reading the Bible by itself wouldn't do.
Hmm.
There's something about being in the land that's very special.
Hmm.
Really, every time I've taken somebody there, every time anybody comes to dig with us, they always say, I had no idea it was like this.
Hmm.
It's really been life-changing.
Wow. Dr. Steve Collins, coming to us from Jordan, digging up biblical Sodom. Thank you so much, Dr. Collins, for your time. God bless.
Thanks, Skip. Always a pleasure.